to call the meeting together of the Housing Finance Policy and Public Health Finance Division. Members, we have a couple things to do today. We're going to walk through the proposed bill and look at the delete everything language that's before us. And then we will have time for public testimony. And I just want to remind members that we're in a process here. This is said and done, but we're in a process here of developing this legislation. We will be taking amendments to this bill through Monday at noon. Members have quite a long time, about almost a week, I guess 6 days, to develop your amendments. And I'm hoping that all parties feel good about that amount of time that we're providing you to look at amendments to this legislation and to give us feedback. I want to just take a moment. People have been working so hard late into the evening last night to try to get this before us today, and so I want to thank our staff, particularly Brooke Borson and Melva Ratke, who last night, I know, were here till quite late, as was, I believe, Emily Abrams. I'm not sure what time you got to go home, Emily Cleveland. Let me see. Jake has been called in numerous times to help on all of these issues. And Danielle, we're actually going to start with you today on presenting the bill. So, and Danny, I'm not sure how long we kept you here, but maybe we need to keep you here even more, so that you will be busy in the next few weeks. So, I want to thank also all the advocates for all the different issues who've been working with this committee. You've been terrific providing us with information. We want the county to continue to, you know, give us the kind of input that we need to go forward. You'll notice that we had a change in our target, and that is set out here through the bill. And we'll talk about that as we go through the legislation and point that out. There's also a correction page that's in your packet, and I hope that members of the audience have that too. And Emily, we'll incorporate the discussion of that when we get to it, huh? Emily Edens will incorporate that. So unless there's any further thanking, I want to thank all the committee members on both teams. We're just, as I say, we're in a process. This isn't by any means our final version, but we hope it's a long ways towards that. So, Danielle, would you go ahead and start taking us through Article 1? I know that you worked really hard on that. I want to again thank you for all your effort putting that together for us for today.
Madam Chair and members, Article 1 is Housing Finance Agency language. Section 1 on page 1 of the DE3 amendment is from Representative Gardner's Minnesota Manufactured Home Relocation Trust Fund bill, as is Section 2. Skip to page 4. Section 3 is from the governor's bill, and this relates to the rehabilitation loans. On page 5, section 4 is also from the governor's bill and relates to rehabilitation loans. And then section 5 on the bottom of page 5 and continuing on to page 6 is another section from Representative Gardner's Manufactured Home Relocation Trust Fund bill. And that completes Article 1.
Thank you, Danielle. Mayor? Emily, did you want to... Well, I guess we keep going to the next part. Oh, we'll just go through all the language first. Never mind. Emily, can you go forward with...
Sure. Madam Chair and members, Article 2 starts on page 6, and that's the Department of Health. Most of this article is from the governor's budget bill, and it's dealing primarily with various fee changes. So section 1 through 4 is all from the governor's budget bill. And on page 8, section 5 is from House File 1819, which the committee heard. It's Representative Murphy's bill relating to services for children who are deaf or have hearing loss, and this section increases the fee $4 per specimen. And then sections 6 through 16 are all from the governor's budget bill. And I believe the Department of Health is here if you have specific questions on these sections. On page 13 of the DE3, section 17 is also from House File 1819, which is Murphy's bill, and this section deals with or provides the services for families with children who are deaf or have hearing loss. And then sections 18 through 36 are all from the governor's bill. So the next added section is on page 27. So page 27, section 37, this is from House File 293, which is Representative Rood presented as a colorectal cancer screening bill. And this section is the one that gives provides state funding for state-only medical assistance funding for any cancer treatment of cancers that are found through this program. Section 38 through 42 is from the governor's bill. And on page 35, section 43 is the actual colorectal cancer screening prevention program from House File
293.
Page 35, yep. And on the next page, section 44, is from House File 504, which is Representative Kahn's Women's Heart Health Program. And the repealers are from the governor's bill. I think they're, looks like they're definitions from dealing with Lead Poisoning Prevention Act, manufactured home licenses, and then there's a fee for a duplicate certificate for certification food managers. And those are all the repealers. So then, Madam Chair and members, Article 3 is the Health-Related Licensing Board fee changes. These were all in the governor's bill and were presented by the various committees earlier, or I'm sorry, various boards in this committee. It does include the fee decrease that we just heard, I think, last week from Representative Abler related to the Social Work Board. And then the appropriations all start on page 42.
Thank you very much, Emily.
Madam Chair and members, in order to not make this too complicated, I think I'll just stick with going through the riders in the bill and the numbers in the bill. And these are they're sort of cross-referenced in the totals on the spreadsheets that you have, but let's start with the bill and then I'll kind of go through the spreadsheet a little bit after that. Because the changes are, I think, stand out a little bit more in the language. So the first thing on page 43, we'll start with the Department of Health. And the first rider shows this is the governor's recommendation to do a delay in payment for the local public health grants. And that total is slightly different, the $5,060,000, than what was in the governor's recommendation because the committee decided to do, or in the bill, there are grant reductions as well. So that number changes just slightly. So the grant reduction is the next piece. In the first biennium for years 2010 and 2011, the reduction is 2.55%, and then that increases in the second biennium up to 5.5%. The colorectal screening appropriation is $100,000, one time in fiscal year 2010, and that is the next rider. The one following that is the Women's Heart Health Pilot Project, $100,000 for fiscal year 2010. And then the language following is TANF appropriations. And that those aren't, that's not new. There is base TANF funding that the department gets, and that's what this language represents. So that hasn't changed. On page 45, subdivision 3 is for policy, quality, and compliance. And that piece of the health department is typically in Representative Huntley's committee. We have that in here because the rural pharmacy planning rider that appropriates $100,000 for fiscal year 2010 is technically in that area, but that's the bill that we heard in this committee. So that's why that's included under there. Then for the health protection program, the only change there was for grant reductions as well, and at the same rate, at 2.55% for the first fiscal, two fiscal years, and then for the second biennium, it increases to 5.5%. And then administrative support services, there's no rider here, but that base, the decision was to reduce that base by $4 million for each biennium. So it's a reduction of $2 million per year, which is slightly higher than what the governor recommended in his proposals. So down to the health-related boards. The first rider that you see there is a transfer from the special revenue fund of $10 million. The health-related boards have a fund balance, and so this just takes $10 million from that fund balance and transfers it to the general fund. On page 46, you'll see all of the boards, the health-related boards, going down this page with appropriations. And these numbers reflect an increased authority to spend money that they collect from their fees. So some of these are kind of reflective of some of the changes that were proposed in the governor's budget. There are a few riders underneath the Board of Nursing Home Administrators that I think are interesting to point out. The first one is just, and it's out of the total that they have on line 13 on that page. So out of that total, some will be appropriated for operating costs. There are some one-time retirement cost needs that the board has had. And then there's liability coverage for volunteer health care providers as well. And then if you look on page 47, there's an additional $200,000 a year out of that total for things that come like contested case hearings that they might have, or any other unanticipated cost of legal proceedings. If you remember, they spoke a little bit about those kind of things coming up when they testified. And then just the rest of the boards are listed right there. Down at the bottom of page 47 is the Emergency Medical Services Board. And there's more detail on page 48 for that. That board received some general fund money and some state government special revenue money. What the writers point out is the longevity award incentive program, so that they set aside a portion of the general fund amount that they get for that longevity award. The rider underneath that is transferring just $100,000 out of that longevity award to be is transferred out to the general fund. And then the health professional services program uses all of that state government special revenue money that is appropriated under that section. And then for the rest of the board-related items, the only change is for the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. The first year total, that $1,655,000, is the same, but then there's an administrative reduction that begins in fiscal year 2011, and that was the governor recommended doing that reduction. His proposal was to start it in 2010, and here it starts in 2011 and it's ongoing. Okay, now if you look at the Housing Finance Agency appropriations on page 49, this is where I made a little mistake, and so there was a memo that some of you may have seen, but what I wanted to point out was that for the challenge program, the reduction to the challenge program does not begin until fiscal year 2012, so the total for 2011, that's on line 18, rather than being $7.867 million, it should be $9.017 million. So that's the same, it should be the same as it is in fiscal year 2010. So I apologize for that mistake. And the changes to the challenge program were similar to what the governor recommended. And so what this total, the $9 million, what that includes is the program consolidation of urban and tribal Indian housing. So it takes the money that was separate and puts it, and it's now all funds under the challenge program. And that's what this rider refers to, being used exclusively for housing projects for American Indians. So that's a net change of zero. There's also a reallocation of $2 million per year out of the challenge program into the housing trust fund program, and that's reflected in this number. And then the reduction to the challenge program won't begin until fiscal year 2012. And in 2012, that's when this $9 million will be reduced to $7.8 million. So then the totals under that are pretty straightforward. The housing trust fund, the rental assistance for mentally ill. All of the rest of them are pretty straightforward, I think. Oh, the only other change I wanted to point out is on page 51 at the bottom. There is a transfer that the housing agency wished to do of disaster relief contingency funds. So it's taking $1.5 million that was previously obligated for disaster relief contingency fund for something else will be transferred in order to use it for grants for temporary rental assistance for families with children who are homeless and need of emergency shelter facilities. And then subdivision 12 on page 6 of line 52, or I'm sorry, page 52, line 6, is the network program that we heard in committee. It's the demonstration project for high-risk adults, and it's an appropriation of $250,000 per year, and it's this is just one time for this first biennium, so it's a total of $500,000 for the biennium. And then on line 18, the appropriation to the Commissioner of Finance of $5,000 a year, this was needed to help pay for administrative costs that are incurred under the change to the Minnesota Manufactured Homes Relocation Trust Fund. So that is why that's there. Okay, now if you'll look at page 53, this is where the Department of Human Services appropriations start. And I'll point out the rider that's on line 23. This is what Chair Clark was referring to as the additional money that changed the target a bit. So in fiscal year 2010, there's $5 million of stabilization, federal stabilization funds that are used. So that's what this $5 million is for. And then some other increases in spending that are under this area, the homeless and runaway youth, they received an increase in fiscal year 2010 of $238,000. And then in the second biennium, so starting in fiscal year 2012 and ongoing, the base will be increased by $119,000. For the food shelf programs, it's an additional $275,000 in fiscal year 2010. That's a one-time increase. On the next page, on page 54, supportive housing services receive an additional $1.5 million for fiscal year 2010 and $1.5 million for fiscal year 2011. And that total $3 million appropriation is one time for that biennium, but that base will be increased in 2012 by $68,000 per year. And then the community action grants, this is a proposal that was similar to the governor's recommendation. It's just a little bit less than what he recommended, but it reduces the community action grants by $1.7 million in fiscal year 2010 and 2011, but it's just one time for that biennium. And the hope is to offset that reduction with federal funds that are available under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. Okay. Not to bore you with the spreadsheets, but I'll just kind of explain how to read them quickly. If you look at the housing policy and finance spreadsheet for the Housing Finance Agency, we went through this briefly before, but I'll just sort of iterate what's on here. the columns that are to the right, you'll see first it's the governor's recommendations, and then the difference between the governor and the base, and then the House recommendations so far, and the difference between the House and the base. And so the items that are under that first economic development and housing challenge program line, those are some of those changes that I talked about with the program consolidation of the urban Indian and tribal housing programs, the reallocation of the $2 million a year to the housing trust fund, and then the 5% program decrease, that was the governor's recommendation, and that's where you'll see that that amount is a little bit lower for the House recommendation, and it doesn't begin until 2012 and 2013. And then everything else is basically base numbers. And then the only thing is at the bottom of that big box, there's the demonstration project for high-risk adults. That's that one-time funding. And then at the very bottom, the Department of Finance administrative appropriation for the manufactured homes change. So then I'll quickly show you the other spreadsheet. It's the public health finance portion. And if I'm going too fast, you should definitely feel free to ask me questions later on this. But what this doesn't show the change items. This just shows the program total. This is how we appropriate in the bill. So under the Commissioner of Health, the first line will show you the total appropriations. And again, it's the governor's recommendations are in the first couple columns, and then the House recommendations after that. And so it just shows all of those sort of overarching programs that we appropriate to, the community and family health, the policy, quality, and compliance, which is typically in Representative Huntley's committee, health protection, and then administrative support services. Underneath that, you'll see all of the health-related boards, and this is the area where it's all those state government special revenue funds. So you'll see all of those totals. And I guess an interesting thing to point out is on line 27 under health-related boards, you can see where you can see the difference in spending if you go all the way to the right under where it says House minus base. That's where you see an increase of 1.9 spending over what was the base. And so that's sort of that increased authority to spend that was put in the bill. And on page 2 of that health spreadsheet, it has the rest of the boards, and then the EMS board, the Council on Disability, the Ombudsman, and then the Commissioner of Human Services at the bottom. So I think that's it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for going through those. Committee members, we have, I guess, about an hour, and there's quite a few people signed up from the community who'd like to give us some input. I'd like to go to them right away. We'll all have a chance to talk about this as committee members as we do the markup next week. So I have a list of about 9 people, I think, and we'll take those. If you can all keep your comments about 3 minutes, I know that might be hard, but we'd appreciate that. We'll try to get through that, and in case there's others who didn't sign up, I need to. If anybody who didn't sign up who was requesting testimony today, please let me know or let one of the pages know, and we'll try to see if we can fit you in. So the first person I have is Sue Hayes. Habitat for Humanity. Welcome, Sue.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Sue Hague. I'm the President and CEO of Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity, and I am here testifying in support of the additional funding for the Challenge Fund this year. I really appreciate the chair's work in putting additional money into that. It's an extremely important resource for all affordable housing developers. We at Habitat for Humanity develop affordable home ownership for very low-income people in partnership with the families who build the homes, with the volunteers from the community who help to build the homes. But this public resource is extremely important to us to be able to help acquire sites for construction and to put more family into decent affordable homes. With the foreclosure crisis of recent, a lot of people have said, well, isn't there money coming from the federal government and shouldn't that be sufficient? The money coming to the state of Minnesota for NFP program to help acquire properties that have gone into foreclosure is enough to acquire only about 1 in 10 properties. So there is a great need that is unmet with those additional resources, so we are grateful for them. In addition, even if we could in some way acquire every property that had gone into foreclosure, rehab it, or if appropriate, need to build it again to return to home ownership for a low-income homeowner, there'd still be 30,000 people in this state of Minnesota who are inadequately housed. 1 in 8 of every low-income family is paying more than 50% of their income for housing. And housing is absolutely a critical need for kids to succeed at school, for families to have stability so they can be successful at work, and for safe and thriving neighborhoods. And the Talent Fund is the resource that really helps us as a Habitat organization and other housing developers do the development work to create that stability for families and neighborhoods. So thank you very much. And I just have a real brief brochure I can pass out to the committee talking a little bit about Habitat.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Not. Thank you very much for your testimony. Next we have Mark Brunner, Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Sure, my name is Mark Brunner. I'm with the Minnesota Manufactured Modular Housing Association, and we represent essentially the factory-built housing industry, the builders, the home sales centers, as well as the manufactured home parks and communities. And there are about 1,000 licensed manufactured home parks in the state of Minnesota. And the parts of the bill that I'd like to address deal with the trust fund, and then there are a couple of proposed changes to licensing that I want to comment on. But I appreciate Representative Gardner and his work in addressing an issue related to the trust fund. The Manufactured Home Trust Fund was enacted in 2007 as a way to address an issue if a manufactured home park were to close because of redevelopment, which is typically the case where it may become a Walmart or maybe redeveloped. The trust fund was established as a way to make sure that the residents or those homeowners receive some type of compensation in a more uniform way than what had previously existed in statute. And so what it requires is that the owners of the properties essentially collect $12 a year from each of the residents, and they in turn forward the money on to the Department of Finance, or MMB. And what one of the things we've been trying to work out between the industry and the advocates is just a better way to facilitate the collection of the $12 fee. And what the bill does is puts in place of another sort of mechanism whereby if the owner of a manufactured home park doesn't send in the required form in terms of showing who actually paid their $12, who didn't, then they are sent an invoice by MMB for the total amount that should have been paid. And we support that change, and we think that will just help with the notification process. However, in subdivision 6, which is the page 1, line 7 of the bill, that enables the owner of a property to collect $1 from each of those residents if they get this invoice from MMB saying that you didn't pay. We don't think that language is necessary. If somebody didn't comply initially with the statute and they get an invoice, we think they ought to pay it, and however they choose to come up with the money is something that they can deal with. But we don't think that this language is necessary. But we do support the rest of the language in terms of the invoicing. I just on a couple other issues in section 40 of the bill, page 31, lines 23 and 24 that deal with licensure. I mean, the change here we think would be a little better if on line 24, if, for example, instead of saying operated in accordance or according to all, and then goes on to list parts of the state building code, if it just simply said that it's taking out the word operated and say maintain in accordance with the state building code, our concern there is that it could be interpreted that when someone needs to have a license renewed, which is annually, that they would need to maintain their property, the infrastructure, in compliance with any recent changes that were made to the state building code, which typically isn't how the state building code works. But our concern is if there were a change in the size of pipes required to deliver water through the infrastructure of the property by a half an inch, that it could be interpreted that, well, now in order to get your license renewed, you need to be in compliance. The state building code addresses that in terms of the only time somebody has to update the code to their structure would be if there's a major rehabilitation or improvements that are made. So that's one section that we think could use a little clarification. A couple other issues: the fee increases that are being proposed for licensing. We do have some concerns. I talked to a couple of my members in Ramsey County and said, how would this impact you? And they said, well, based on what's being proposed, it would nearly double their annual licensing fee. We talk to the department and try to get an understanding of just exactly what the need is in terms of having to increase the licensing fee by that amount. And finally, in Section 5, sort of the sunset provision that's extended there beyond 2009, we do support that and think that it's reasonable that if there were a shortfall in the fund, since the fund is still new and getting established in terms of compliance, we think that's something that's prudent and reasonable. And that concludes my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Ritter. Any questions for the witness? Okay, if not, thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. David Aaron, American Cancer Society. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Aaron, Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society. I'm here to testify and say we very much appreciate this committee's support for the inclusion of Minnesota's Colorectal Cancer Prevention Act into this bill. We've testified before this committee before as to how important it is to provide colorectal cancer screening, particularly to people who either have no health insurance or who are underinsured and who would not otherwise be able to access this type of cancer screening. A couple key facts about how this bill would impact colorectal cancer screening. In the bill is $100,000 for one year for two institutions to provide colorectal cancer screening. We believe that this would allow about 80 people to be screened who probably would not otherwise have received colorectal cancer screening. Out of 80 people, about 25% of those people will have polyps, potentially precancerous polyps. Don't know until you do the pathology as to whether it will be cancerous or not, but about 20 people. We also think, based on statistics, that about 5 of those people would have cancer. So we believe that this particular amount of money that you inserted into this bill would prevent 5 cancers. What we do know is that the cost of treatment of low stage cancer, meaning cancer at its beginning stage, costs approximately $60,000 per person to treat. At the high end stage, it's $200,000 to treat based on statistics. So if you took 5 people at $60,000 in treatment per person, that is saving $300,000. So $100,000 saves $300,000 in treatment costs for those five people alone, and then gives 20 people peace of mind by removing the polyps, and hopefully they won't have to be screened for another 5 to 10 years, depending on their doctor's recommendation. Now, what this amount of money also does is help set us up for potential federal matching money if Congress will act on H.R. 1189, building co-sponsors on the U.S. House of Representatives. It would create a stream of 3-to-1 federal matching dollars. And Minnesota, if this demonstration project becomes law, if you will, would make us eligible for special consideration for those federal matching dollars. So if we get our work done and create this program, then I'll be asking each of you to write your member of Congress to urge the federal piece of this to come through so that we can truly have a public-private partnership between the federal government, the state government, and nonprofit organizations, including hospitals, the American Cancer Society, so it really is a partnership to prevent colorectal cancer, a very unnecessary killer in the state. Thank you very much. I'd be pleased to take questions, but appreciate this committee's strong efforts on this bill.
Thank you very much. Is there any questions or comments, committee members? Okay, thank you. Next person on the list is Tuwatla Phillips, Inland Transitional Housing. Who here? Okay, well, maybe she'll come a little bit later. Rachel Callanan, American Heart Association. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rachel Callanan. I'm Senior Advocacy Director at the American Heart Association.
There you go.
Better? I'm Rachel Callanan. I'm Senior Advocacy Director at the American Heart Association, and I want to extend thanks to the committee for including the Women's Heart Health Promotion Act in this bill. I extend that thanks on behalf of the hundreds of women that will benefit from the screenings that will become available as a result of this $100,000. I want to share with you just a couple of points that heart disease and stroke and other cardiovascular diseases are the number one cause of death for women in Minnesota. And Dr. Mary Boylan was here earlier this session to testify before this committee. And she made, I think, a really important statement, which really reinforces the direction of this legislation. She said that really the only cure for heart disease is prevention. And so this bill focuses on that prevention, that women, low-income, uninsured and underinsured women who will otherwise not have these very basic screenings done, it will provide them those screenings. I also wanted to share with you just a little bit about some recent data from the Office on the Economic Status of Women. They did some analysis of this legislation that demonstrates the cost-effectiveness of screening women. The average cost of care for treatment of someone hospitalized with heart disease is $108,000. So by preventing the hospitalization of just one woman, we will have paid for this $100,000 in this bill. So I think that's a great sort of contrast. I also wanted to just share with you a quick story about a woman who has already benefited from screenings available through the federal funding for this program. Arlene Francis is a 63-year-old woman from Brooklyn Park. She had this heart health screening done through the Sage Plus program at the Uptown Clinic in Minneapolis. She was uninsured at the time, as both she and her husband had lost their jobs and therefore their medical insurance. The Sage Plus program made a lasting impression on Arlene. She joined the Fruits and Vegetables and Steps program within the Sage Plus program and started reporting her daily exercise and her servings of fruits and vegetables weekly to the Sage Plus program. So that's one of the ways that the program helps, is helps people really keep track of their health and their progress. Arlene started walking 5 miles a day, 5 to 6 times a week, as a result of participating in this program. And Arlene's dedication led to changes in her extended family. Her daughter and 2 grandchildren who had moved back in with she and her husband started walking with Arlene and eating healthier, and since she has lost 30 pounds.
So this woman has had an impact directly on others around her. Arlene reports that she loves cooking healthy and feels good about the healthy food she's able to provide for her family. In addition, her grandchildren love eating the healthy food. So she's having an impact on the next generation. So Arlene is very appreciative of the Sage Plus program. She feels very good about the changes she's made in her lifestyle and the impact it's had on her health. This could be the similar story of hundreds of women across the state of Minnesota as a result of this $100,000 investment. So I thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Kellen? Thank you. The callback is next, and then I see Sue arrived, so we'll take Sue out of Phillips after we have you can correct. You can catch your breath for a minute, Sue, and we'll hear from Sue first. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Chip Hallbach with Minnesota Housing Partnership. And first, I just want to express my appreciation to the chair and the committee for working with leadership and getting the increase in the housing budget that's included in the proposed budget. In particular, we are very appreciative of the additional funding that's going into the Economic Development and Housing Challenge Program. Has been expressed earlier that a very flexible program. It meets the most pressing ownership and rental needs across the state. As we look at the budget, we do see, however, that the challenge fund would still decline by $4 million from the current base. And of course, that's because of the transfer of that $4 million from the challenge base to the Housing Trust Fund for supportive housing. And we at the Housing Partnership do support that type of transfer in helping the state achieve its goals and long-term homelessness. We do call attention to the fact that this is just one leg of the stool, which also includes supportive services. As the committee has added an additional $3 million for supportive services, it still leaves short some tens of millions of dollars needed to sustain the supportive housing that's already been created. So there's still a disconnect between the money that's going to support the production and operations of the housing and what's really needed to make supportive housing work. So I hope at some point the committee can address that. But as I said, this current proposal in doing it leaves the challenge fund with $4 million below what it had received or what the base budget is. So that leaves us with a tough situation. And what we look back on is what the legislature did in 2005 when it was faced with from the governor, a proposed reduction of the challenge fund. The House and the legislature as a whole was able to restore funding. But they were only able to do that because they decided that it was more important to put money into the challenge fund than two other important housing finance agency programs. One is the Homeownership Assistance Fund, which has $1.7 million in it in the proposed budget. All of that was taken away for a biennium by the legislature. And the other funding that was reduced was part of the money for the rehab loan program, about $2.3 million. So after seeing the proposal coming from the chair, we're doing a survey of housing providers across the state to see if once again they would bring to the legislature a recommendation of making that trade-off again to restore the challenge and taking funds out of those two other important programs. I should say both of those other programs are revolving loan accounts, money goes out and gets repaid more rapidly than it does with the challenge fund. So that is a dilemma before us all, in that there's a variety of very important things to do, and we're now surveying to see if we would recommend to the legislature to keep that challenge fund whole, which we consider, because of its flexibility and its utility across the state, the priority program for the legislature. Two last notations I had. First is, as was mentioned earlier, the challenge fund itself will be combined with the Indian Housing Program, which has been the situation a number of years ago. I would ask the committee to consider having that money exclusively available for Indian Housing for the first 18 months, and then if it's not all utilized, it would be available for other challenge fund uses. And then finally is that I see that the proposed draft on page 52 makes recommendations for priority use for the emergency shelter grant program, which is the resource coming to the state to address, to keep people from being homeless or rapidly exiting from homelessness. And there, it's a recommendation that there be priority use for these federal resources coming into the state for homeless youth, American women, victims of trafficking, and high-risk adult males. I certainly know that homeless youth is an extremely important need in the state. I know less about the other two, but I do caution the committee and the legislature putting these priorities in, because I know that in other parts of the state, there are other critical needs relate that these funds could address. One that I've heard of a number of times is about battered women, and that there's inadequate resources to help battered women get into permanent housing, which this funding could help with. And then the other high need situation are families facing homelessness due to foreclosure, either renters or owners facing homelessness. So I'm just not sure if it makes sense for the legislature to pull out these three priority needs to the exclusion of other ones that I know that are out there that these federal funds could be very valuable for. So with that, Madam Chair, again, I appreciate the work that the committee and you are doing with working to restore some of the cuts that had been proposed earlier, and looking to work with you and the Senate to make this budget happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Halbach. Any questions, committee members? Thank you very much. Okay. Thanks to Wallace Phillips. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Scott. Can you come back, Ms. Halbach? I'm sorry, I didn't. Can you come back? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if this is a question for him or not, but if we look at page 52 and those priorities, are those priorities that are set by, are they conditional upon us receiving the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act fund? Do we set those priorities as a committee, or were those set by the funds that we're getting?
For instance, Scott, those are priorities that the committee set.
All right.
Thank you. Maybe that's not a question for you. Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Sue Watlow Phillips, Executive Director of Elam Transitional Housing and President of Integrated Community Solutions. Thanks for the opportunity to testify again before this committee. I apologize that I am late. I'm doing two intakes with young women that have children that are homeless right now, that have no longer been able to stay at their home, that are coming into our transitional housing program. And both of them are interested in being nurses. I'd like to mention to the chair, who is also a former nurse.
So if you could take the time to talk with them.
committee members, I want to thank you for your incredible work in pulling together this bill, which I think has been obviously a great challenge. And obviously for all of us that work on housing and homeless issues, we certainly appreciate the efforts to try to keep as much money available for homeless and housing programs as possible. Home is critical. It's the base for all of us doing well in our community. It's the basis for all the different things that we are going to be able to do. So while most of us in this room are going to go home tonight, we have thousands of people that are not going to be home tonight in Minnesota. So again, I want to thank you for the good work that you did as far as trying to put as many dollars into this program. I'd like to turn back to page 52 of the omnibus bill and would like to hand out two handouts in talking about the information in regards to the emergency shelter grants program. It's Article 6 under the Human Services Appropriation. As you're getting, as you're getting these handouts, let me recognize that the Department of Human Services Office of Economic Opportunity has been noted by the State Legislative Auditor's Office as having consistently fairly distributed dollars to the populations that need to be served with the resources that they have available to them from both the state and from the federal level. As you're getting the two pieces of paper, packets of paper, I'm not going to go through them in detail, but just want to talk briefly about the emergency shelter grant program dollars that we are receiving through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009. One of the pages has the information that I handed out last Friday in regards to the amounts of money that we will be seeing coming into the state of Minnesota. I'm not going to go over that again. What I'd like to talk about is the process that happens with those dollars coming into the state. So the state of Minnesota receives $10,865,236. To accept those dollars, to receive those dollars, we have to do what's called a substantial amendment to our state consolidated plan, which is the plan on how we tell the federal government, HUD, how we're going to use our home dollars, our other ESG dollars, our HOPLR, Housing for Opportunities with AIDS dollars, and our community development block grant dollars. So we already have a plan, a five-year plan, and we do annual updates to that plan, and then we have to do a substantial amendment that we also get as a public 12 days to comment on what the state decides on how to utilize these dollars. I would echo what Chip said earlier in regards to having specific populations in this omnibus bill potentially creates some difficulty with us creating a response to the federal government in regards to the substantial amendment. The other handout that you have are the questions and answers in regards to the substantial amendment, the first page, and then the back of the second page talks about what's required on that. And then the last several pages is the actual copy of the substantial amendment that we have to do, or the State Housing Finance Agency and the Department of Human Services will be doing in conjunction in responding to the availability of these dollars. So it's not just a simple process that these dollars come to the state, we get to decide how to use them, and then they move on. It's a process where we have to say in an amendment to an existing plan how we will utilize those dollars, and then to make sure that those dollars meet with our current expectations under the consolidated plan, and with additional research that would demonstrate that there are different additional populations that need additional special assistance, for us to say that we need these dollars to specifically go towards or prioritize towards specific populations. Obviously, ELM is a very large provider for homeless youth. We work with women that have come out of prostitution. We have Native American staff members. And we work with folks that are coming out of correctional facilities. So all these priorities are very dear to our heart with ELM Transitional Housing. But we would just be concerned by having this in language that it really potentially decreases the flexibility that we have in the substantial amendment, as well as flexibility in the use of the dollars. And again, I think the Department of Human Services Office of Economic Opportunity has done an excellent job in the use of the dollars and distributing statewide. Just in conclusion, because I know that you have plenty of other testimony, I want to thank you for putting one-time money into the Homeless and Running Away Youth Program, also additional dollars into the food shelf program, also some additional money into the supportive housing program, and I am concerned that we are decreasing community action grants and replacing that with some federal dollars, but I will express that as concern. Again, I want to thank you for your support. We are hopeful that with not seeing any additional dollars of the one-time replacement on the emergency shelter program and transitional housing, that we may be able to use some of the stimulus dollars to meet those needs. I am concerned that the stimulus dollars will have more restrictions than the present dollars that we have in the Department of Human Services, so that we will not be able to meet some of our emergency shelter needs in this state now without the additional one-time money being put back into the budget, and that we may have some differing looks of transitional housing in the state and may have to reduce some transitional housing without that one-time dollar. So thank you again. I appreciate the opportunity, and I appreciate the patience in letting me get here to testify.
That's great. Thank you so much for your testimony. Governor Scott and my staff were just pointing out to me, too, that, and it's kind of in tune with the recent testimony of the last two testifiers, the criteria that we have here are in addition to the federal criteria. So I think it was just pointed out very well that there already are federal guidelines, and we are asking the department to look within those. And maybe there's some ways we can tweak the language, but basically that's a better answer to your question than what I gave you at this time. Okay, thank you so much.
Madam Chair, could I just make one additional comment? As I mentioned in my testimony on Friday, we have stimulus dollars coming through multiple state departments from the federal government. And so my concern is that we utilize the expertise within our state departments while at the same time the oversight of this legislative body in how we utilize those dollars. But I encourage that we maintain the greatest flexibility as possible so we can meet the needs that we have across the state with the variety of resources coming back, our tax resources coming back from the federal government to help us across the state.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you
very much. Next person is Kristen Anderson Stenberg. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kirsten Anderson Stenberg. I'm with Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. I am here on behalf of not just LSS this morning, but for all youth-serving organizations to extend a heartfelt thanks to the committee for your recognition of the importance of homeless youth services in your budget, including numerous areas where homeless youth are identified as a priority group throughout the bill. Through your meetings with youth and providers, your attendance at events like the Culture Club Art Exhibit in the Capitol North Hall, there all week this week as well as the week of the 20th, in case you haven't already seen it, and in many other ways, we thank you all for your support. Youth who experience homelessness are our children. 70% have had some contact with our out-of-home placement systems. Many on the streets would be eligible for our care if counting to the resources in child protection to protect adolescents. We are working with you to improve our systems, and yet the fact remains that over 1,800 youth are homeless in our state every night, and they are our children. After gaining the courage to seek support, these children are turned away from shelter every night all across the state. Being offered bus tokens in many cases is our best recommendation to fend off cold, dark, and predators of the night. Many of these youth are faced with unthinkable moral choices. Provide sex to receive shelter, consume substances to fend off the cruelty of homelessness, and other compromising acts performed in the name of survival. With a projected need of $46 million to meet statewide need, the $238,000 appropriated, and even the $357 projected for the coming biennium are important, and yet small drops in the bucket.
We appreciate the desire to extract stimulus dollars for youth and are seeking creative ways to target spending and are still seeking clarity on how we can effectively fund this critical continuum of care for our children with those existing dollars. We will continue to work with the committee, the department, and any other experts we can find to identify those answers. We know from the evaluative research conducted on the 2007 $1 billion investment you made in homeless youth services that the dollars you allocated were very well spent. Squeezing every drop out of the appropriation, these funds touched over 7,000 youth statewide. As needs continue to rise, we know that this $238,000 will also be very well spent. And we know it is simply not enough. Our children deserve our best efforts. We know that investing in youth at critical times means the difference between hope and despair, between the building of trust and the building of fear, pursuing higher education or participation in petty crime. Fundamentally, the economic question becomes, do we invest now in the well-being of these resilient youth, or do we wait until all hope is lost and spend big on corrections and long-term homeless services? Again, our most sincere thanks for all of your hard work and our encouragement to please not let down all hope. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any comments or questions from your members? Thank you so much. Next, Steve Kramer, Project for Pride and Living. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Kramer. I'm the Executive Director at Project for Pride and Living, PPL. We're a multi-service agency in the Twin Cities focused on helping low-income families become more self-sufficient. Part of what we do is develop and sell affordable homes, and we also develop, own, and manage, along with and provide support services, affordable rental units throughout the Twin Cities. I'm also a member of the Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers, a number of agencies that do similar work. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, at PPL, we see in our work the direct value of all the activities that you're struggling to fund for this biennium, from health care to employment support to education and everything else. But, and let me say, for families and individuals looking to move forward, it's not just one thing, it's many things that make a difference. It's many things together that help people help themselves towards a stronger future and to help realize their full potential in our community. But as others have said, housing, stable, quality, affordable housing, is the most fundamental of all building blocks for greater self-sufficiency. Unfortunately, as the committee knows, fewer and fewer Minnesotans can lay claim to stable, quality, affordable housing. Since 2000 and through 2007, there's been a 90% increase in the families statewide paying more than 50% of their income for housing, meaning one in eight households are in that unenviable position, a trend that certainly has accelerated last year and so far this year as the economy has further weakened. In the metro area, 70% of low-income households pay so much for housing that it's difficult to afford other necessities, and we've certainly seen in recent months a spike in shelter use and a great demand at agencies like PPL for housing, for rental housing, particularly larger bedroom apartments, which I think is very much related, as others have said, to the foreclosure problem. Families needing three or four bedrooms often rent a home. A home is foreclosed out from under them. They're at an agency like ours trying to find a very scarce resource. So I think all of that suggests that an increase from the governor's proposed budget in housing is a very worthy choice among the many worthy choices that you're considering this year. This biennium. Funding for the challenge program at a higher level is especially important. Others have said that the program is flexible. It crosses both rental and ownership. It's targeted affordability needs. It also leverages other funds. I know that when my agency puts a project together with using challenge funds, we have multiple other sources that come to play so that the state invested dollar means other dollars are invested as well. It also can have rapid impact. There are many projects in the pipeline, so a secondary benefit of this increased spending in the challenge program, if it occurs, will be a great economic impact throughout the state. I also applaud you for the increase in support of housing services.
supportive housing serves rental housing serves families facing the most significant barriers to stability and success. And in supportive housing projects, the housing and the services must really go hand in glove for there to be success and for the families in turn to succeed. So that increased funding is also much needed and will make a critical difference for hundreds of people throughout the state. So thank you for your efforts. Appreciate the opportunity to comment this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Cameron. Any questions, comments from committee members? Okay, thank you very much. I have one more person who signed up to testify, Ms. Lee. Are there any others in the audience who desire to be placed on the list to testify today? Okay. Welcome to the committee and introduce yourself, please.
Yes. Madam Chair, honorable members of the committee, I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International R&R Family Center. We provide services to children's families, the elderly, the disabled, and victims locally, statewide, nationally, and internationally in a multitude of areas, quite like PPL. However, we're focused on certain other priority issues areas. The reason I'm testifying is I wanted to first explain my experience. I'm a CPA, MBA, PhD, with a former corporate auditor, realtor, lender, university instructor, small business owner, doing farming and having other positions. So I can certainly appreciate legislators here who have had more than one job or have two jobs at the same time. Years ago, I was assaulted and almost died. And I wanted to prevent what was happening to me from happening to many others because it was happening to others. So I came to the legislature to try and fix injustices and broken systems wherever I could. I wanted to explain how this relates to the bill that is before you regarding the omnibus, because we have tried to fix what we saw as a broken system related to home ownership counseling and the bills that we're going through related to that. In your bill, you address the family homeless prevention, the home ownership assistance, and the home ownership education counseling and training in various sections under Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. What has transpired is that they were able to replace this home ownership center has been replaced in another bill with the same authorities given the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency without the regulatory controls, the accountability and transparency of a state agency. Now, we're not sure what language will end up being that will address that. However, they have funneled it so that they would approve all counseling agencies in the state, which has us concerned as far as, and this their bill that's also traveling through finance will ask for dollars. So we're concerned about the duplicated funding that's going to be available both in your bill and this other bill that's going through as far as doing the same thing. They're also getting funding from the federal government, which I understand all agencies getting funding from the federal government have to ask the public for donations and sliding fee scales and so forth. They are purporting to provide services for free, which aren't really free, especially if they're coming to the legislature and asking for tax dollars to be able to fund the program. So we're concerned as far as from the consumer side, what really is free and what really is being paid out of tax dollars, so that that's clarified. And so we would like to see clarification on the funding going through not being duplicated. And the other issue would be as far as some of the accountability and transparency, and that if you are asking for state or federal dollars, that your services be available and open to everyone with equal opportunity and justice. Because currently, the existing home ownership program has discriminated against members of the public who are, they're supposed to be providing free services for. They've turned them away. They have discriminated against other counseling agencies, other realtors and lenders. So we are just asking that as far as how it relates to your bill, that this be further identified and clarified so that those following the funding on the bill as it's going through other committees also be aware if there's any duplication and matters. Also, because just to alert you that the counselors that are going to be approved by this agency, they aren't all qualified in the areas that they will be providing counselors to members in. I know this committee has heard budgets from the health department and perhaps the human services, I haven't looked. And these state agencies do have licensure procedures and regulatory measures where they can best provide those types of services to the public. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Lee. Any questions or comments from committee members? Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to provide testimony to this, on this bill to the committee? If not, then just a reminder to committee members that we have about almost a week here now, 6 days to give us your input, feedback. Committee members will be doing markup next week. The deadline for amendments is Monday at noon, and then we will be continuing to mark up the bill on Tuesday. If there's no further business to come before...
Oh, excuse me, thank you.
Thank you, Jake. I need the minutes for April 3rd to be approved. President Saylor moves the approval of minutes for April 3rd. Any further discussion? Not all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. I do want to just say one final comment. I appreciate all the testimony today. This is a hard job for all the folks here at the table and for our agencies. I want to thank our state agencies too for all the work that they've done, showing up at the committee, providing testimony, and helping us understand what's being proposed both by the governor and what we are putting before us. So I want to thank you all. We are dealing with a cut in this committee. We need your ongoing advice and involvement as we take the bill forward. Thank you very much, and the meeting is adjourned.